This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 24th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're coming to you this week again from Phoenix. We're going to talk about some of the key things that happened this week in the area of federal taxes. First thing we're going to talk about today will be a discussion of the proposed regulations the IRS issued regarding the extended time period for rolling over certain distributions that are made to pay off an employee's loan when they separate from service or when a plan is terminated. We'll talk about those special rules. We'll also talk about a letter from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, and a few other entities that was written to the Treasury Secretary, Speaker Pelosi, and Majority Leader McConnell regarding problems with the payroll tax holiday and the fact that essentially the Chamber and the other organizations are stating that many, if not most, of their members will simply ignore the issue unless we can get some sort of guarantee of forgiveness in place already. We have the IRS warning employers not to use Form 941X until the new revision comes out at the end of September if the employer is trying to change a second quarter 941. We also have the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee that wrote a letter. Letters are big this week, to the IRS questioning why they were sending notices to people that dealt with payments that supposedly had not been made, when in fact the problem is those payments are sitting unopened in trailers at IRS service centers. And the IRS did respond relatively quickly to this letter from the Chair of Ways and Means. Obviously, you prefer not to upset the Chair of Ways and Means if you are the IRS, because that could have a negative impact on your budget and other issues. So we did see a fix of sorts there. We also, this week, the IRS began accepting electronically filed amended individual income tax returns, which is good news. The bad news is it's only for 2019, so it's not going to solve that problem of trying to do a five-year carryback, and you thought the 1045 faxes weren't moving very quickly, so maybe we'll do it instead by doing amended returns on 1040X. Sorry, those 5 years ago, 1040Xs will still have to be paper filed. And finally, the IRS began paying interest for taxpayers who got refunds where they filed their return after April 15th, but on or before July 15th. That's due to the special rules under Section 7508 that allow, if the deadline is pushed back due to an emergency, that the IRS will not wait the 45 days they normally wait it before they would actually allow a payment to be treated as a basically being short too long and having to pay interest, but rather pay interest beginning on April the 15th. So those are a few things we've got today. But let's go to the proposed regulations on that bit that I think some of us even forgot was in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. This is Regulation 116-47519. It was issued on August the 17th of 2020. If you recall, back at the end of 2017, one of the provisions in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was a provision that tried to deal with a problem that we've seen clients run into. A client had borrowed money from their 401k at work. They change jobs, they get laid off, you know, something happens. So they end up getting a distribution from the plan, or they're forced to have the loan deemed distributed. And I should watch the use that word deemed distributed, because actually that's a slightly different concept that doesn't count. But they have this loan treated as a distribution because no longer can they qualify under the terms of the plan, since the plan required loans to be paid from paychecks. And obviously, if you're not working there any longer, you're not getting a paycheck. Well, the problem with this was, under prior law, the employee had 60 days from the date that theoretical distribution took place to take money out of pocket and complete a rollover. Obviously, many clients didn't realize that was taking place. Others, you know, just basically, I didn't get a check. Or even worse, they got a check for their total balance less the loan outstanding. They did, or they directed it to be rolled over by the employer, didn't realize there was a loan offset. And suddenly, when the 1099-R comes out in January, we're telling the client, sorry, but you owe tax on $30,000, which is the balance of the loan that was outstanding with your former employer, with the former employer's plan, I should say, when you left service. So that presented some problems. Congress decided, well, we need to give these people a bit of a fix. And the IRS actually takes this concept and takes it a little bit further than the law stated, which is a good thing for our purposes. So we'll take a look at this. Now, the key question is, what exactly qualifies? And the term the IRS is going to use here is qualified plan offset amount. And you'll tend to see the acronym QPLO is used in here. I suspect that may start being picked up in various discussions of this. So just get used to QPLO is this amount that can be rolled over later. And things that are QPLOs have to meet one of two qualifications. The offset of the plan loan had to occur essentially predominantly because of one of two reasons. The employer has terminated the qualified retirement plan. That is terminated. Now, it could have been because the employer was sold, so we have a new company taking over. It could be because they just got tired and terminated the plan, distributed everything. Now, if they do terminate because they get sold to a new employer, if that new employer essentially adopts a brand new plan to continue the old plan, it won't count. The regs tell us that. So it has to be a pretty straight termination. The more likely reason we're going to see it, the more likely reason I've ever seen it, is the second problem. There was a failure to meet the repayment terms because they borrowed from a plan that, by the terms of the plan, required the loan to be repaid from payroll tax withholding. And obviously, once you leave service, there's no payroll tax to withhold against because the payment security, kind of, you know, the assurance that we get paid, disappears. The plan requires immediate repayment. Obviously, most people don't have sitting around the 30 grand they borrowed from the plan to repay instantly because that was why they borrowed from the plan. So that often gets this quasi-deemed distribution. Got to watch that term because, again, deemed distributions don't count. Deemed distributions are used in the regulation to deal with with something treated as if it was distributed, though it's not actually considered a distribution, if you fail to qualify or meet the terms of the plan, you know, or the loan. So let's say that your loan did not require you to pay it back from your paycheck and you were supposed to give them a payment and you started missing payments. That will get you into a situation that would get this deemed distribution where you're still required to repay it, but you know, you also have to pay tax on the distribution. That can be a really bad situation. So we'll talk a little bit about this. Now, as I said, the key problem here is it's got to be primarily because of this reason. And there are a series of examples in the regs, and they're actually pretty useful for what the IRS considers, you know, due to this case and not. One thing that becomes clear very quickly, if the participant is in default before the participant is terminated or before the plan is terminated, they're not going to consider this a qualified distribution. They will still allow the rollover, but it's going to have to be within 60 days, not this extended period. So again, if somebody is in default already, you'll take a look at the examples and make it pretty clear, but that's not going to qualify for this purpose. So that probably doesn't happen often, and it's more an issue that the plan administrator is going to worry about because they're going to issue the 1099s that indicate if we have a QPLO or not, presumably. That looks to be how the IRS plans to run this. So if you have a QPLO, so we've got one, the distribution is due primarily to one of the two reasons, termination or severance, we can contribute up to the extended due date of the return for the year in which that distribution is considered to have taken effect. So let's say that we got a distribution here today. We have this, we did our main rollover, and the employer did this offset. So I have $200,000 going to Schwab, and I have $30,000 that is this loan that's going to be offset. Well, that $30,000 will be the QPLO. The $200,000 is still subject to standard rollover rules. So if I took a distribution of the $200,000, the employer, because a qualified rollover distribution, would be required to withhold 20%. So that would mean I'd get a check for $160,000 if I took the check. If I do the direct rollover to the Schwab IRA, I get the full $200,000 transferred. If I get the check, I still have to come up with that $40,000 that was withheld for taxes, and there's no choice but to withhold it, in order to get a full rollover contribution. So remember that. This does not solve that problem. However, it does point out that we don't have to withhold if all I have is this offset. So let's take the standard situation. The employee directed the entire $200,000 to Schwab. We have this deemed distribution of 30. The employer or the plan is not required to withhold on the 30 because there is nothing to withhold from. You can only have to withhold if there's something to withhold from. So in that case, there's nothing to withhold from. We will end up with no withholding. If we do have cash coming out, we can catch up that withholding on the loan as well. So in my example, I should have said I assumed the $200,000 was all we had. In my example, we actually would catch up most likely the $6,000 on the loan as well. So we'd have $46,000 withheld, and we'd have to make that up out of pocket. But the nice thing about this is, so I have it, I do this right now, I have this $30,000, I have, per the law, until the due date of my return for 2020, so April 15th of 2021, or if I go for an extension, the extended due date, which would be, in my case, individual, October 15th. However, the IRS has decided that Regulation 301-9100-2, which is normally a late election statute, that they're going to expand, in their view, that to cover this situation. So what that means is, even if I file my return on April the 1st, don't get an extension, I will still have until October 15th of 2021 to complete my rollover. So everybody gets to the extended due date of their return to complete the rollover. So that's a nice feature, right? The IRS expanded that, so there's time in place. Now, this regulation has also clarified one thing that really had never been talked about in the regs before. The qualified, this distribution when we're doing an offset. For this offset to work, the offset has to take place within 1 year from severance or termination of the plan. Termination of the plan is probably going to take place right away. So severance is key. So the good news is a plan does have a year to, let the employee kind of figure out if they're going to pay it back. And then we could roll that, or if they are going to just take it offset. So we did have that clarified. Now, these are proposed regs, but they are with the clause, which happens in a lot of proposed regs. In fact, most of them these days, the IRS rarely issues temporaries. Used to be we'd get temporary regs and proposed regs at the same time. Once we got to the point where the IRS was restricted and temporary regs can only last 2 years, we began seeing more and more, and these days rarely see temporary regs. Rather, we see proposed regs with the theory taxpayers may rely. That means that you don't really have any guidance except this. But if you do this, we're fine. Now, it means theoretically you could go against them without disclosing you're going against a reg because the reg's technically not binding. But it also means that this is the only guidance we've got. And the likelihood is you're going to have to follow it or an agent will challenge you. And while theoretically, I know I saw a recent discussion where an attorney was concerned about why the AICPA was all upset about the notice on non-deductibility of things paid with PPP loans. The theory being, well, that's not really binding. It doesn't matter. The court's going to ignore it, et cetera, et cetera. My takeaway, which is that's all correct and all true. However, in the real world with clients, most of our clients do not want to end up hiring a tax attorney to go to court to deal with this IRS position. They don't want an exam to deal with the position. They don't want to go to appeals. So bottom line, most clients, when you tell them about something like this, are going to go along with whatever the rule is the IRS has come up with. That's why, to be honest, I still think it's really important that Congress clarifies absolutely that anything paid with PPP loan proceeds is deductible. But I do agree with the attorney who said that, yeah, theoretically, it's not binding on the courts. It's not that issue. But I would not agree that it's not something that you have to, something you can ignore telling the clients. I just think attorneys sometimes get all into this litigation mode and let's go fight. And that's great. But last I checked, it costs money to fight. It costs lots of time to fight. And my clients tend to hate either one of those. So bottom line, it's difficult. So again, these regs, probably what we're going to be using for quite a while until the IRS gets around to finalizing. And we'll see if there's any changes when they finalize. My guess is any changes will be minor. I don't see anything in here that I think people are going to get all upset about or is going to cause the IRS problems with finalizing these regs. Next up, okay, it's the week of the letters. This letter came from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but signatories included all kinds of industry organizations, including the National Association of Manufacturers, which is a big industry organization. It's titled The Implementation of the Executive Order Deferring Payroll Tax Obligations in Light of the Ongoing COVID-19 Disaster. The Chamber certainly doesn't believe in giving short titles to things. It is the letter officially from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce with the co-signing organizations, which I believe there were 25 organizations in total on this thing. It was issued on October 18th of 2020. So as I said, we have the Chamber, we've got all these other organizations that are in here. They're mainly industry-style organizations for various business groups. I will say the AICPA is not on the letter. I kind of understand why. And neither is the ABA. They both have written their own letters, and probably their letters will have influence on their own. I mean, they're always giving advice to the IRS and Treasury, so it's not really anything new. But both of them have called for very similar items to what's in this letter. The Chamber says, look, this is a problem. This, you know, what was in the executive order, or, well, the memorandum to be technical about it, that the president issued that was going to defer employee old age survivor and disability insurance. That is the amounts normally withheld from an employee's paycheck. And that deferral, I got news for you, it starts in just a little over a week. If you're listening to this on the 24th, the Monday that it's officially posted, you might be listening on the weekend, we get it posted. But in any event, it's going to be that the first paychecks you'd have to worry about this are going to start to be issued in not much over a week. And in fact, depending upon when you're listening to this, could be less than a week. And of course, you listen to it after September 1st, you may already know how this gets answered. But the problem the Chamber says is this. It's very straightforward. And I think it's very realistic what the Chamber says. The Chamber says, look, there's a big problem here. Our problem is that with no, you know, if there is not going to be any cancellation of this amount at the back end, if it is merely a deferral, and the authority that's cited in the memorandum is 7508 Cap A, it is merely a deferral mechanism potentially. And we get a whole long argument whether you really can defer payroll tax deposits. I will ignore that issue for right now. Let's ignore that. I understand the argument, but let's just ignore that for a moment. We're not going to get into that discussion of the regulations under 7508 Cap A. But they said, here's the problem. Let's take a worker, somebody on my payroll, rank and file worker on the payroll. Let's say that this worker has annual salary of $50,000 a year. We pay biweekly payrolls, and you know, we end up getting our checks every, you know, we get 9 checks between September 1st and the end of the year. Obviously, it depends upon when you pay and how things work, and biweekly cycles get a little bit interesting, but most biweeklies will have 9 paychecks over that period. So I think that's kind of a safe, good way to start. The Chamber points out that this employee will see, if we don't have withholding, he or she would see their wages go up by $119.23 a week, or every 2 weeks. Okay, that's fine, except because this is a deferral, come the end of December, they will have run up a bill of $1,073.08 that they will need to pay to the IRS at whatever point and however we're getting this repaid. Most people would assume that repayment is going to probably come 1040. There is some concern that they could try to get it from employers, which obviously makes the employers unhappy. But the, you know, the bottom line is the Chamber said, we don't want the employees of our organizations, our members, they don't want their employees mad at them because you caused me to owe $1,000. This is horrible. Because by the time they owe it, I guarantee you, most are going to kind of have forgotten that 119 whatever in their paycheck. and they're going to instead come back and say, why do I owe this? Those that do and that you explain, oh, this guy has to pay this back, is going to ask, well, then why aren't you taking it out now? Because remember, the vast majority of taxpayers look for this big refund from the IRS. You know, they want a refund at April 15th, and this is going to offset that. So bottom line, or even potentially have them have to write a check. So the chamber's position in this case said, look, most employers, many of our members, if not most, are probably going to decide not to do this. The Treasury Secretary indicated, we discussed last week, that employers will apparently get to decide if they want to do this. And the chamber said, you guys need to be real about this. With no forgiveness, employers aren't going to do it. They're just going to get employees mad at them. You know, we're going to have trouble. This repayment is a pain. Now, I realize that, you know, Larry Kudlow, which is the, I guess, now chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, will say, well, maybe we can somehow spread this out over 5 years, so it really won't be much. It's like, well, I don't know that authority exists to do that. And secondly, they're still having to repay it, which is a problem. And the chamber also points out that maybe, which AICPA did, you suggest that employees make the decision. But the chamber points out, and I fully agree, that that's not really a workable solution. You're putting a lot of compliance issues on the backs of payroll departments if employees make this call and you have to decide yes or no. And you're probably still going to have the same problem because they're going to say, sure, raise my check. And when they owe it, they're going to say, why didn't you tell me about all it's going to owe? I don't have $1,000. You need to pay it. We're going to get down that whole line. And the letter concludes, and I think somewhat snarkily, but it, you know, it's okay. And it was written, remember, to the Treasury Secretary, the Speaker of the House, and the Senate Majority Leader, said that you should be looking for a path that supports rather than burdens workers. They're saying this is not going well. We're just going to probably ignore it. And so if you want this to work, we need guidance. Now, bad news. We are still sitting here. I'm sitting here on the morning of August the 22nd, recording this on Saturday morning. We still do not have Treasury guidance as far as I can make out. I haven't seen anything posted anywhere telling us how to handle this. My guess is they really understand the problems and they just kind of want to ignore them. They are hoping that something else gets fixed before then. Because otherwise, we've got to say, yeah, you got to pay it back. And the news cycle on that's going to be, shall we say, devastating. So probably they don't want to say it. And so I'm guessing that we won't hear that for a while. But the problem is payroll departments can't make these changes on one day's notice, which some may have to do. So, yeah, we'll see if, in fact, this letter gets followed. It did get publicity, which is good news. The bad news is, though, so far, we still haven't seen anything from the IRS stating that, oh, yeah, we understand, or from the parties the letter was written to stating about how they're going to really solve it, except for Mr. Kudrow's, you know, discussion of, well, let's pay it back over 5 years, which I just don't see as a reasonable solution, to be honest. I really think that's going to be a problem. But your idea may be different. I just see the five-year payout as a real pain as a practitioner to track and keep up with. And yeah, just too much mess. Now, another little problem that Congress created that the IRS is dealing with right now is the problem that payroll tax reports got a lot more complicated in the second quarter. Remember that? We are now dealing with from the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act and the CARES Act, we have to deal now with, you know, the payroll tax credits for the leave that came in the Families First Act, and we have to deal with the employee retention credit, right? And we have to deal with this deferral of employer side of old age survivors and disability, all that sort of stuff. So the 941 for the second quarter has a lot more lines than were there in the first quarter. However, if you want to change any of that, you know, you deal with Form 941X. 941X has not yet been updated to deal with these changes. We did get a draft version out. You can go look at it online. If you go to IRS Draft Forms and ask for Form 941X, you will see a draft. The IRS announced on their website information about filing Form 941X for 2020 second quarter, posted on Monday the 17th, that you know, okay, we realize that. We expect to get this revised form out in September. Now, here's the catch. You've got a problem. You discover you have some issue with your second quarter 941 and you want to fix it. Okay, let's go through the IRS's theory about 941Xs right now until we get to late September and the issuance of the revised 941X. The IRS says, if you are revising the first quarter of 2020 or earlier, then you can go ahead and use the 941X that exists right now. Remember, you cannot use the draft form. That's do not file. So you can go ahead and use the 941X that exists right now if you're changing the first quarter of 2020's 941 or earlier. However, if you are dealing with any later periods, they, in one situation, very strongly ask you to hold off until the revised 941 comes out in late September. In two other situations, they absolutely tell you not to do anything. Okay, situation one. If you are making a change to the 941 for the third quarter, for the second quarter, and you aren't changing the employer FICA, right, or anything with the credits where we have new lines for the credits for the leave time, right, those things from that, or the employee retention credit. If you're not changing any of that, they strongly recommend you wait for the 941X, but they stop short of saying don't do it. I would still probably not do it because you've been forewarned. And I could see a lot going wrong because especially the IRS won't get around to processing this thing most likely until well into maybe even next year. Now, I do understand if you owe money, you may be thinking, yeah, but my interest, everything's running. So I understand that problem. And in that case, maybe you say, forget it, IRS. I know you don't want this, but I'm doing it because this isn't barred. The one that's barred, though, the two things that are barred, number one, if you are making any change to a line that was added to the 941 in the second quarter or that deferral of payroll taxes, it means you also make a change there. If you're changing any of that information, absolutely do not file the 941X. As well, they said, never, ever, for any reason, for any period, just take a 941, right, amended across the top or some other similar site, not, you know, thing across the top of 941 and send that in. That also is not to be done. Now, they do say, if you have already done one of those things that you shouldn't have done, you now find out you shouldn't have done, they say, well, you're going to have to wait until you see what we do. It is possible we will simply reject it as non-processable, in which case then you'll have to file a new 941X, and presumably if there are penalties involved, you know, interest and penalties, you'll have to pay the longer term interest and penalties. We'll see if they let people off for that. My guess is you'll have a better chance of getting off if you amended before the 17th of August when they told you not to send it in. But anyway, you know, we'll keep that up. So their bottom line is make sure you wait for that. Now, that said, so if you have a change, keep your eye on the IRS's, and it's actually something that you can do every morning. If you actually go to the IRS's published forms list, they'll tell you when new forms appear. So all you got to remember is if I have to amend a 941 for the second quarter, I want to revise it, I just keep going on and wait for the day that 941X shows up in that list as having been posted, and that means we can go ahead and file this. Now, letter number two of the week, and this one did get action. This letter came from the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal of Massachusetts. He, in a letter to the IRS Commissioner, Charles Rettig, dated August 19th of 2020, wrote about something that a lot of us know a lot about because we've been talking to clients about this all week. So let's talk about what came up. What the chair wrote about was, they said, in essence, due to, you know, the office closures and everything, we understand a lot of mail is way, way, way backed up. And due to that, you've not been able to open and process mail timely, right? This is okay. Now, the real problem we have that triggered a bunch of things, and I found it was mainly with trusts, that did it. The IRS has not processed certain mailed-in payments for this reason. I'm not going to say for sure, but my gut tells me that if you have a trust return filed at July 15th and that trust owed tax and you paid that tax by check, you probably got the notice that, oh, you didn't pay. You owe us, you know, whatever thousands of dollars that you owe us, even though it was already truly paid. Well, that did get a lot of notice. Representative Neal says, look, IRS, you should not be sending notices out telling people they haven't paid when you know that you've got a huge number of checks sitting in those vans, right, unopened. You should stop doing it. You should stop sending notices. These just create stress for taxpayers, you know, who are getting these things and now want to know if they owe the IRS money. And if it really gets bad, because what they'll end up doing, which will make things even worse, is they go ahead, write that check for $8,000, mail it to the IRS. Now it's in the van. Now it goes into a van there behind their first check. And somewhere over the next few months, we end up with both checks clearing, and they would still keep getting these notices. So, you know, Representative Neal said, IRS, you know, really, come on. We just need to stop the system, right? Make sure that we don't do this. So he asked them to stop sending the check, you know, stop sending the notices. The next day on the IRS website, the IRS posts a notice. Right, so the IRS comes back in a day later, and they end up posting on that day later in their response. They're saying, oh, okay, we kind of get it, we understand. So a day after he sent his letter, the IRS addressed the issue. And what the IRS says in their response a day later, which is entitled IRS Temporarily Stops Mailing Notices to Taxpayers with Balance Due, actually it was 2 days later, as I should say. It was, we got this from their website. They basically say, okay, here's what's going to happen. They did not promise not to send the CP-14, which is the initial statement stating that, you know, you have an unpaid balance off your return. But they are going to stop sending the follow-ups, the CP-501, 503, and 504. Now, those are in increasing nastiness, the follow-up notices app for taxpayers who did not respond to the CP-14. So if you did not respond to the CP-14, you would get those generally in order of 501, 503, 504. 504 is threatening to levy and lien and do all those things. And as most of us know, having worked with this before, they tend to come out automatically, right? It doesn't really take any work. They come out automatically. So regardless of what we do, we end up with these things just coming out. And whether we like them or not, you know, we end up with them in a stack of them if the IRS hadn't gotten around to processing. And normally in good times, that would have been, or good enough times, that would have involved you calling the IRS and trying to get a hold place in the account. Now, as you're aware right now, the IRS has trouble answering the phone. They, you know, they're overwhelmed with calls and issues and problems because of all these things that are out there that they did. And, you know, the chairman points out, this is the second time you've sent out notices that are a major problem. Remember, all those that got printed while the service centers were closed got mailed out, many of which had dates to act that were before they were mailed. You know, and they said, IRS, this is the second kind of major foul-up you've had on notices that somebody should have figured out was a problem. So he said, you know, we need you to do something. So they're doing it. Now, the catch is, while they say they won't send those two out, interesting enough, they do still suggest responding to the CP-14. But they tell you, please don't call. So apparently, they want you to respond by the due date. Your response in 99% of the cases I know of, because, yes, there are a few cases people didn't really pay. If you didn't really pay, yeah, you should pay. Strongly recommend you pay electronically. So does the IRS in this notice. Suggested it. If you got a notice you owe them money, and you really do, electronic is going to be the much better way to follow up with this, because that will get in the system and will stop the computer from sending out new notices, presumably. We'll cross our fingers that all works. So bottom line, you know, send it in, do it electronically, use the website. If you take a look at our materials this week, we have the actual suggested website, but it's a basic IRS payment site that you can directly take money out of a bank account. So you're allowed to go do that, Go ahead and do it. But make sure you respond. The reason you want to respond, presumably, is if that CP-14 is correct in some way, and it really is a balance due, you want to make sure you did respond timely. So I would suggest put your response in, make it clear you're responding, even though you're pretty sure they have the check, and you're pretty sure it's due the backlog, but keep the certified mail receipt for proof of timely filing so you can show you timely responded to the service, because, yeah, I expect problems on that going forward. You know, the IRS's systems, we all know dealing with their computers, that the computer is really difficult to dissuade from continuing to send nasty letters out and trying to claim the old money. So I don't know how well this will work. They also warned that it's going to take them some time to shut down the secondary notices, so you might still see a few over the next few weeks. So we don't know when they'll really be able to shut it down. Okay, couple of better news things coming. Let's say a better news things coming up here too. First thing is the IRS announced on the 17th, you know, with news release 2020-182, that the IRS Form 1040X electronic filing became available. Now, even though the headline says generic 1040X, you quickly discover when you read the notice that they're only going to accept 2019 amended returns, and it's only Form 1040 and 1040SR. So first thing is, it's not going to help you with, you know, amending a 2016 return or a 2017 return, you know, due to NOL carrybacks, etc. You still probably want to use the 1045 faxing and hope that works. Remember that you're supposed to fax those in now. Rather than trying to do a 1040X, I'm sure some people thought, I'll use the 1040X when I do it electronically because, hey, that'll get ahead faster. Not going to work. Once you send it in, even or with a paper one, you can still file paper. You can check the status of an amended return. There's an IRS website they mention, again, in our materials. If you download them for this week, as to where's my amended return online tools, you can follow up, see if it's been touched yet, see where it is in process, and do it. The news release notes the IRS receives 3 million 1040Xs each year, so this has been a goal to try to get this done electronically so we have fewer problems, which I guess would be a good thing. You know, I think probably makes sense. We'd like to do this electronically, assuming if we can. And also, I think it's really important to remember, given the delays in mailing we just talked about, in processing mail, I suspect it strongly makes sense to try to do the electronic 1040X once your software is able to do it. My understanding is a lot of software was actually, you know, had the capability kind of turned on in the background prior to the IRS's announcement they'd take it. So I think a lot of you will find that you can electronically file a 1040X. Now, that said, please remember that probably states are going to take a little bit longer to catch up. So you might have to paper file the amended state return, but at least the federal return can go in electronically now. That should make it simpler than it's been otherwise. The final piece of good news, the IRS announced in News Release 2020-183 on the 18th, a day later, that they have begun sending the interest payments to taxpayers. You may remember we discussed this earlier, that due to Code Section 7508 Cap A's delay rules, under those rules, if they invoke 7508 Cap A, we no longer wait 45 days, right? Normally, the IRS has 45 days from April 15th, if you file before that date, to process your return and get you your refund check out, or if they don't go within that time period, they have to send you interest on the refund amount. This says that for taxpayers that filed on or after April 15th and who basically filed on or before July 15th, presumably that's in there because if you didn't file by July 15th, then even without 7508A, if you had to go beyond that date, you know, you were not going to get interest. That's kind of how that would work, right? Because you would be getting money for your later filed return. We don't pay interest on that. But if you filed by July 15th, you're going to start seeing interest apply in the tax account or in your bank account. And it'll apply to 2019 returns filed after April 15th, 2020. And again, it's only 2019 returns. So if you filed a late 18 return, that's not going to help you. And we're filed by the July 15th delayed deadline. So if those were true, now I should say to modify that just slightly, if you had a fiscal year 18 return that had a due date, fell within that time frame, the same basic rules should apply. You know, so we'll see the same issue. So it is possible that you might have had, I don't know, just trying to figure out what could clip it. If you had something that came within that due date, it might happen. So maybe, and I'd have to even double check the idea whether extensions get clipped by this as too. So if your extended due date was in that time frame, do we get the refund for that? Again, not terribly clear from the extended due date to July 15th if pushed. I suspect you might, but that'll be an unusual case, so I understand why the service is not exactly wasting a lot of ink on that. It would confuse taxpayers. The payment will come by either direct deposit into the bank account, so warn your clients that if they had direct deposit of their refunds, or they got direct deposit of refunds, they probably should keep their eye. Money may pop up in their bank account. Some clients don't notice that. Or they may get a check. And certainly I have had reports of these things coming in for people. So I think we're probably under that. I think we're probably good. In any event, this should be the next few weeks. Clients will probably call you about this. Now remember, as the IRS points out, if they got more than $10, the average payment is $18, they're going to get a 1099 INT. Now, as was discussed in a Twitter thread, kind of interesting thing, I believe it was Richard Rubin of the Wall Street Journal that brought this up. It's like, well, 1099s are really to tell the IRS about the interest that's been paid because you are supposed to report even one penny of interest. And he said, it's somewhat funny because in this case, the IRS doesn't need to be told about the interest. They already know about it. So even if you've got one of those clients who thinks I don't report interest, I just won't tell the CPA about it. You know, if it's less than $10, this might be a case where you'd say, look, the IRS could get picky and actually chase you down for anything. Because they know about this, they paid it. If they paid it, they know you got it. So bottom line, it's one of those interesting asides. So we'll see. The interest is done. Now, I do have some CPE courses coming up. Again, this year, everything is online. I have two this week with the Montana Society of CPAs. First is the Advanced Partnership Issues, featuring the new audit regime. I've had a lot of people discuss the audit regime recently. I've had a lot of feedback on that. You know, we start talking about the new partnership audit regime, and I think a lot of CPAs got blindsided by that, so it's probably important to understand. That'll be on the 26th. On the 27th, I'll do income taxation of trusts and estates, and we will talk about the Montana Unified Principal and Income Act. For those who aren't aware, Montana tweaks the standard Uniform Principal and Income Act a couple of ways that are a little bit unusual. Basically, what's normally principal and income, if you know the Principal Income Act, you know that a lot of times if there's a payment that clearly would consist of both and they don't want to deal with it, there's no obvious way to divide it, that the Principal Income Act just says 10% income, 90% principal. Montana changes two significant payouts to swap it to a different, higher percentage income. In fact, in one case, 85% income and 15% principal. In the other case, it's less. It's just 15% income and 85% principal. But yeah, they do that. So we're going to talk about the Montana-specific Uniform Principal and Income Act, and then just the general problem with trust. We'll talk about that. So that's there. We're also going to have a session I mentioned for the New Jersey Society of CPAs on September 1st. That'll be the PPP loan forgiveness and other recent COVID-19 developments. We're going to spend most of that course reviewing the PPP loan program, all the ways your client could lose forgiveness. And that means we're going to talk about, some of the special problems, the FTEs, the safe harbor rules, the other issues, but also talk about, because the SBA has indicated that we're going to review whether you should have gotten a loan in the first place and whether you got the proper amount of the loan. So if you're helping your clients to doing due diligence or doing financial reporting, you want to make sure you've considered, did they qualify for the amount of loan they got? Because if they didn't, that's going to be a problem too. Presumably, the SBA will want the bank to catch that. Or if the bank doesn't, the SBA may catch it on their review. So we want to kind of talk about all those exposures we've got now that we're in the forgiveness phase of the PPP loan program. That will be at the New Jersey Society of CPAs. In either case, you can go to Montana Society or the New Jersey Society of CPAs websites. You can sign up for these courses. They are webcast. If you're a member, you do qualify for discounts. If you're not a member, you can still take these courses. You'll just have to pay the full price. That's one of the keys. Or join the society in question. Maybe you just like that. Maybe you actually do work in those states. So maybe you want to join those societies. So whichever way it works for you. This is Current Federal Tax Developments for this week. Our updates are posted on the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions, you can send them to me, Ed Zollers at CurrentFileTaxDevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, at EdZollers. I tend to post updates there and other issues as they happen. I do follow the discussions on the State Society's websites for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, and Washington, you know, to some extent, at least keep up there. And I do try to watch every so often the Tax Talk discussions on CalCPA. That last one is open to any CPA or EA in the country. The other sites are basically open only to members of those societies. If you're a member of one of them, you can check in there, and I'll try to get back to questions. Otherwise, we got another week coming up. We're going to hope like mad that we actually get some guidance on that payroll tax deferral. Because if we're sitting here, if I'm sitting here a week from today, and we are still with, we don't know how it's going to work, that's going to cause us some major problems. Now, if I had to bet, I would bet it'll be later in the week. I do not think that for lots of reasons that the administration would like to have this kind of story pop up and take some, you know, sheen away from the national convention the Republicans will be holding. When you renominate the president, you know, you would like that to be the lead story, not a discussion about how this crazy program works. So my guess is if we get the guidance, it may come out on Thursday or Friday. I apologize to all of you who do payroll because that's not going to leave you any real time, but we will keep an eye on that and hopefully have something for you next week. Otherwise, tune back in next week. You know, we'll take a look, see what's happened, and talk to you about what's going on in current federal tax developments.